I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Dr. Martin Horacy from the University of Montana. If you've ever seen a shooting star or found a rock that might be a meteorite, this show is for you. We're talking about meteorites in Idaho. Peter, have you ever found a meteorite?
I've never found one, but I've seen several of them in some museums, and it's one of those feelings where you're looking at something that's not from this earth.
Well, you know, I have the good fortune of being in a museum, and we have a number of meteorites on hand, and one of my favorite things to do is to hand a real meteorite to a little kid and tell them, you're probably never going to hold anything older than this. And that usually gets their attention.
Well, it gets my attention, too. I'm a 49-year-old kid, so that would be actually
awesome.
Cool. First, though, I suppose we better get into some nature news
again. Hey, tell us about something new.
All right. Jesse Granger of Duke University has been interested in how sunspots and solar storms affect whales' sense of directions. So a sunspot and a solar storm, they're linked, and they're basically sudden releases of high-energy particles from the sun that have the potential to disrupt the magnetic orientation of the Earth's magnetosphere.
Okay, I'm with you so far, but did you say whales?
Gray whales.
Like as in swimming whales?
Okay. As in swimming whales.
All right.
So she and a team of colleagues were looking at 186 live strandings of gray whales. And what they found out is on high sunspot days, more than double of the strandings occurred.
So the probability of whales getting stranded seems to coincide with solar activity.
Solar activity, yes.
What?
And with further studies, what she saw is that with increased high solar radio flux, which just is basically solar activity, these strandings actually go up four times. So not just double, quadrupled with the strandings.
That's bizarre.
Yes.
Okay.
But she wanted to look at strandings when there's some large deviations in the magnetic field. And there was absolutely no significant increase in strandings when the magnetic field was disrupted.
Wow. So did they make the connection? So
what they think is what's happening is these whales have a magnetoreceptive sensor. And with the solar storms and the high solar radio flux, it disrupts this sensor. And they're not getting lost. They're basically becoming blind.
Because they're not able to perceive direction the same
way
they would normally?
No, it's basically if we closed our eyes and started to walk, we're going to run into things.
Sure.
So these solar flares disrupt this magnetoreceptive sensor. And they kind of use that, you can say as a guide, but it's also kind of like eyesight. So when that sensor gets disrupted, they're basically swimming blind.
That's a lot to take in.
That's a lot to take in. And it also leads to the next question is when we look at some of the sonar that we as humans are using throughout the oceans, is that affecting?
Is that having an effect on
that receptor and that sensor as well?
That's fascinating. Well, thanks for bringing that to our attention. I wouldn't have thought there would be a connection between solar flares and
whale sight, in a sense.
Absolutely. Wow. Thank you. Okay, so today we've got an out-of-this-world topic, of course. Trivia time. Idaho has a history of meteorites being found here, and our trivia question has to do with that. What Idaho meteorite is a major showpiece in the Smithsonian's collection at the National Museum of Natural History? You'll be surprised.
Yes.
It's pretty cool. We're going to talk about meteorites right after the break.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome Dr. Martin Horacy. He's from the University of Montana. Thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Well, thank you. glad to be here, and I love your podcast.
Thank you. You know, I remember you from back when you were on faculty here at ISU, and I got to know you a little bit. I know you're really fascinated by meteorites. Could you tell me how you got into meteorites as a point of interest?
Sure. I was actually a high school classroom science teacher in Idaho, and some of the courses I taught were Earth and Space Science. And it was easy to make Earth science hands-on. Had lots of mineral samples, rock samples you could pass around and study. But I wanted to make space science hands-on as well. And I realized that it was possible to get a hold of meteorites, even own them, collect them. And so I started doing that. First started with the teaching collection and then just kind of ballooned from there. And that was 30 years ago.
That's great. And the next very obvious question is, what is a meteorite?
Well, a meteorite technically is when a meteoroid survives a trip through the atmosphere and lands on the ground intact. That's called a meteorite. A meteoroid is an object, a natural object in space, and it can be anything from dust grains to, you know, size of asteroids. And then when it's flying through the atmosphere and causing a bright light, we call them meteors. And then, of course, if we can recover the thing on the ground, then it's called a meteorite.
And so what size are these objects when they come screaming through the atmosphere such that they make it to the ground? Is there a sort of a minimum size they have to start from in order to actually leave a solid material you could pick up?
Well, actually, they could be very, very small. It's possible, you know, to have dust and or it depends on quite a few things. I mean, the Earth is spinning, so if you're coming into the spin, basically your speed is faster, so your chance of burning up is bigger. Sometimes a larger piece fragments. You know, the Earth has basically an atmosphere around it. Well, if you run into that atmosphere very rapidly, it feels kind of like you're running into a wall, so they can break apart. So then you can have small pieces arrive. But there's dust falling out of the sky right now. You know, at least probably 50 tons a day are landing all over the Earth. But we don't usually get too excited about it until something's, you know, ping pong ball size or larger. But a lot of them that fall, a loaf of bread size is not unusual, but they can certainly go to car tire size. And then it's pretty significant if something bigger than that lands. That's when we get a little nervous. And, you know, there are also larger ones that explode in the atmosphere, kind of like Chelyabinsk in Russia. They blow apart. So they can be all different kinds of sizes, but we do look for ping pong ball and larger is pretty much the kind of the standard.
So being someone who is in museums a lot myself, folks come to me on a fairly regular basis and think that they have found a meteorite. Usually it's some kind of rocky object, and they are very curious to know what it is. So could you give maybe a quick primer on how do you initially tell that you might have a meteorite?
Okay. There are, first of all, kind of three reasons that something might come to someone's attention as a possible meteorite. The first is you've got to have a human that's curious. If you're not curious about the object, not enough to pick it up or to study it or it's unusual or something, you know, it stops right there. Another is what's all the background rock like? Idaho is a pretty rocky place, so needless to say, if you're a meteorite in Idaho, your chances of being discovered, you either got to be really unusual or you have to be in one of the more farming areas where you would stand out. And then the third is somebody actually has to bring it to the attention of someone else. And it's not unusual for a rock to sit in a, you know, on a shelf or in a rock garden or used as a doorstop for 10 or more years before anyone says, hey, you know, you ought to get that checked out. And actually that's where a lot of meteorites come from, is they weren't just pulled out of the field. They've been riding around as a plow weight or a barn doorstop or some cool rock that somebody had. And they always kind of thought it was a meteorite, but never went any further. But the way you can tell is to have it analyzed by an actual meteorite lab. That's not going to happen most of the time. So what can you do in the field? One is it look different than the other rocks? Generally, to stand out, it might feel heavier. It might look like a chunk of iron. Meteorites tend to be angular. They are not full of holes. They don't flake off or have look like they have layers like sedimentary rocks. If it's got a broken face, it's not unusual to have the inside a different color than the outside, because the outside, something happened to it, and that didn't happen to the inside. But one of the most common ways is to literally hold a magnet close to it, or better yet, a magnet that's hanging on a string. Unfortunately, Idaho has a lot of rocks that also attract magnets, but that's a good indicator. And if it's slammed up to it, like a chunk of iron, that's a really big deal, because free iron is pretty rare. Meteorites are more common than free iron on Earth. So if you've got something that looks like a big chunk of iron, unless it, you know, was a broken, you know, plow blade or something like that, it's something to get excited about. And then you take it to a university, et cetera, and they do some other tests, like look for nickel would be a common one.
Very cool. So I've got this, and you take it to the university, and they're testing it. And if they think it's a meteorite, you know, what's the next step? Will the university want to use it more, or are they like, yeah, you got a meteorite, and hand it right back to you?
Well, it kind of depends. There are a couple of other tests they may do really quick. They might grind off with a file or cut into it and look and see if there is shiny metal inside it. Are there condyles, which would look like little circles? And then where was it found? In America, the landowner technically owns the meteorite. Other countries, it's different. But if you found it on National Forest Service land or BLM, et cetera, then technically it belongs to the U.S. government, and we don't have a national museum, so it would be the Smithsonian would be the next closest thing. So technically they would be the owners of it. A lot of times meteorites might not be, you know, super special as far as rare types, and the meteorites folks at the museum know that nobody's going to turn in a meteorite if, you know, they have to give it all away. So they usually try to work with the person and allow them to keep some of it. And there are lots of stories where people just change where they found it. There's a famous one in Willamette, Oregon, where a 14-ton iron was literally moved off of a timber company's property onto a guy's pasture. And then he claimed he found it there. You know, you can easily tell he drug it, 14 tons. And that particular one is now a showpiece in the American Museum of Natural History, the Hayden Planetarium, actually, in New York City. So you can go visit that.
So what are some of the common types of meteorites that exist out there on our landscape?
Well, since you said landscape, it's kind of odd. The most common type is would be a stony meteorite, very much just like a rock. And in fact, it would be what's called an H chondrite. That has to do with the kind of the iron content in it. But they look so much like rocks that actually iron meteorites are more common to be found. In fact, of Idaho's meteorites, there have been 8 total distinct meteorites found in Idaho, and only 2 of them are stone meteorites. The others are all like irons. But irons fall very rarely. You're talking about maybe 5% or something like that. Yet they stand out. They're more durable. They're odd. People pick them up and hang on to them. Whereas, you know, the other 95% of the meteorites get ignored or skipped across a pond or, you know, thrown. and so the most common ones are stony meteorites. There are iron meteorites. And then there's a kind of a combination called a stony iron meteorite that is a, you know, half iron, half stone. And there are a couple of different versions of those.
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated with the stone meteorites. How could a person even come close to guessing that it's a meteorite? Will it still be attracted by the magnet, or is it just sheer? Okay.
It's mostly that because you're dealing with the most common types. However, the super rare types may not be attracted to a magnet at all. And those would be like the meteorites from the moon or the meteorites from Mars or these really strange, you know, almost primitive chondrite, carbonaceous chondrites that are almost more like charcoal briquettes. And they are not very durable, so you almost have to see them fall. You know, you just don't pick one up out in the field very often. It's kind of you just have to almost feel like something's interesting about this rock. And that's what a lot of people who find them, they may have never seen a meteorite, and they think, I think this is a meteorite. Now, 99% of the people are wrong when they bring it into, say, a museum and say, I think this is a meteorite. They're all over out here. But occasionally they show up, and it's like, yep, that's it. But usually it's something odd, like you were plowing a field, and all of a sudden you hit a rock. You know, imagine that loaf of bread out there, and you're thinking, I don't remember that yesterday. Doesn't mean it fell yesterday. It means that it, you know, rose up, moved through the dirt, something like that. And that's where the two stone meteorites came from in Idaho. You know, they're basically found by farmers.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was in high school, what?
Oh, I was going to say, so tell us about the you mentioned 8 different meteorites that have been found in Idaho. What are some of the examples of those, and do you know some of the stories that go behind how they were found?
The first one, actually, there's one called Idaho, because we don't know exactly where it came from. It's an iron meteorite. Oddly, they have a distinct classification for it, but no other information anywhere. It might have been studied and then lost. But there's a Hayden Creek iron meteorite that was pretty small. That was 270 grams, which is not much. There was Montview, which was about 26 kilograms. That was found in 2014. Parma Canyon was about a little over a kilogram, or a little over 2 kilograms. That's an iron. Tamarack was 2004. And that was an iron, but it was only 98 grams, or excuse me, that one was 41 grams. Some of these are found by people with metal detectors. You know, they're out looking for coins, et cetera, and they end up stumbling on something unusual. The stone meteorites are Jerome, Idaho, which was about a little under 7 kilograms, and then one called Wilder, Idaho, that was found in 1982, was about 27 kilograms, kind of like a basketball. Jerome was found in 1954. So you can see there's a pretty big gap when it comes to stone meteorites. And in fact, farmers are very good at piling up rocks and getting them out of the field. So sometimes you don't look in the field. You look at where over the decades people would have tossed rocks. So sometimes you'll see people going along rock walls, or they even found them in buildings. You know, they were a building material. So if you know, or put something together. In fact, when I was a classroom teacher, we used to have a potato harvest break. And for a week or so, at least, there was no school, and a lot of the kids would go out and they'd work in the fields, and I'd send them out all with a little magnet on a string. And if they ever picked up a rock, you know, or a potato that wasn't a potato, you know, to hold the magnet by it and see if we could find a meteorite. Never did, but it was kind of a way to keep the science going, even though they weren't in school.
So
one of the coolest stories, Oakley iron, was found by a couple of kids who, one of them was just dragging his axe along. This was back in 1926. He was dragging his axe along the ground, kind of like a kid would, and it hit a chunk of metal, and the rest is history.
That's fantastic. So these are often found accidentally, except for maybe searching with a metal detector. The other examples of when they've been found in Idaho is really by chance.
Yeah. If the only way you can probably deliberately start searching for something like this is if you get into an area that they would really stand out. In fact, sometimes people look for fresh ones on frozen lakes in the winter. You know, something where there's no other reason for that rock to be there, large sandy areas. I don't know if the sand dunes around St. Anthony, there's a lot of rock out there as well, but that's where you might wander around and look. And then obviously dry lake beds, if there is such a thing, where you might be able to just cover large areas on a four-wheeler or something looking for a rock that is really out of place. That's a very popular thing to do in Nevada and California. You just crisscross these giant dried up areas and people are finding a lot of meteorites out there.
So with the advent of our smartphones and recording, we get a lot of video of meteorites coming in. I mean, have you or do other people really focus in on these videos and then try to go out to that site or that location to see if they can find a meteorite that way?
Absolutely. In fact, there are groups, you know, they kind of coalesce online, but they actually are interested in kind of combining all of the bits and pieces of information. And it isn't just smartphones. It's police dash cams, ATM cameras, parking lot cameras, basically anything where they could get some trajectory material or trajectory information and then try to cross-reference that with any eyewitnesses and then literally go out and search. And sometimes it's years later, but there's this track record of information that is kind of pinpointed an area. And that's, it can get exciting. And sometimes, you know, there are big searches and I follow it online and yep, sure enough, somebody was able to track it down and find it, because of, you know, some witness. A lot of times it's way far away. If somebody said, I saw a meteorite come down, I'd say, what did you hear? And if they say, I didn't hear anything, I'd say, you know, there's a chance that was 10 miles away, you know, or maybe even more. And obviously 3/4 of all of them going into water. But it happens. It happens maybe 5 times a year. I think that's about average for new meteorites.
On the larger side of things, if a meteor is big enough, and this happens very rarely, it might actually leave a crater in the land and the Earth's surface. And as far as we know, there's one crater of decent size in the state of Idaho, and that's called the Beaver Head. What do we know of the Beaver Head?
Well, that's an ancient crater. It's actually fairly large. It's like close to the, I don't know if it's in the top 10 in the world as far as size. It's pretty close to that, if not. And it's, I've heard a lot of different ages and sizes, but usually I just like to simplify things. So I'll say it's 60 kilometers in diameter and 60 million or 600 million years old. Easy to remember. Could be 100 kilometers in diameter. I've seen quite a few different numbers, but 60 and 600 are easy to remember. So it's a really old impact crater. 60 kilometers in diameter is pretty big. That big hole in Arizona is maybe 2 kilometers in diameter. So right. It gives you an idea. However, you don't see a crater. All you see is some indications that there was a crater here, an astronomical event, and that has to do with certain kinds of rock formations that pretty much can only be created by extraterrestrial means. We don't have the volcanics or the erosion or any of the processes on Earth that can mimic those. And, you know, it's out by, I think, by Chalice or Salmon. Chalice, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. And so it's buried kind of, in the subsurface. You can't go to a hole in the ground today and see it.
Yeah.
But it's largely inferred.
Nothing really there, which is common. I mean, the Earth recycles. Recycling's good, but you really have to have, you know, some impressive non-weather events and non-geologic events to preserve a crater for very long. I mean, when you're talking hundreds, thousands, millions of years.
600 million years old. It's not going to be obvious anymore.
Yeah, and something that size caused a significant change in the area. You know, there's a lot that can happen when something that big comes down.
So returning to maybe more common occurrences of meteorite falls and then finding them, talk a little bit about the cultural aspects of meteorite incidents and people's actual firsthand observation of a fall.
First of all, the observation or the experience of a fall appears to be fairly traumatic when you read history, you know, accounts of meteorites falling. And it's often, you know, filled with disbelief. There's an old saying, I don't know if it's true or not, but that Thomas Jefferson, upon hearing about what turned out to be the United States' first meteorite fall, was to say that he would rather believe that two Yankee professors would lie than rocks would fall from the sky, you know, something to that effect. And in fact, a lot of times the sounds, it's kind of an interesting timestamp on things, the sound that meteorites make, people look for a, you know, something that sounds like that. So in history, it goes from thunder to horses stampeding to cannon fire to gunfire to, you know, car crashes to buzz saws. You know, there's all sorts of different ways of interpreting this really strange sound. And in fact, the people who experience it, you know, you have very little scale. So, you know, there are stories of airline pilots swerving their jets to avoid incoming, you know, meteors. And actually, they're 100 miles away from it, but they had no idea. And there are people that think it just landed on the other side of someone's house. And you could go 200 miles of everybody saying it's just on the other side of that house, the other side of that fence, the other side of that barn, until you hit the ocean. And a lot of times, like there were some major ones, Park Forest, Illinois, hit a bunch of houses. That particular one crashed through a 12-year-old boy's bedroom, kind of traumatized him. There was one that went through a house or a garage in Michigan, dented somebody's car. You know, they come out and they're furious because their car's got a big dent in it and there's a rock. There's one in Peekskill,
New York. I'm sure it increased the value of the car.
Yeah.
Very much so if they hadn't hurried up and taken it to the body shop.
Right.
You know, and we have this tendency to fix things right away. But anyway, there's a lot of stories where people are just out in the field and all of a sudden they hear kind of a big thumping sound and then whoomp and something lands by them. But we don't have, you know, that happening very often. That's actually the area that I really like to follow and study, is kind of the intersection of culture and science and a meteorite fall. Because it's really forced us, I call it, you know, it's kind of an inconvenient science. It makes us have to deal with things. We had to deal with rocks from space. We had to deal with material from Mars landing on Earth. You know, now Martian meteorites are totally cool. And in fact, I'm guessing that teachers this probably in the next couple of years are going to have to deal with life on other planets in their classroom. You know, we're going to have evidence there was life on Mars. And then you might go back into our meteorites from Mars and say, yep, there it is. We knew it all along, but we didn't know it at the time. You know, we kind of assumed it, but, and we've gone through that. We went through that in 95, I think, with Allen Hills meteorite, thinking that there were indications on it. So you ask about recognizing something. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but have you ever helped with a litter cleanup?
With a litter cleanup?
Yeah, like along a river.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah, absolutely. Yep. Sure.
Yep.
Yeah. So how do you know something's litter?
That's a good question.
That is a great question, probably because we were told it was litter.
You weren't, but you managed to pick up the paper and the pop cans and everything else just fine on your own. You don't have to take it to somebody else and say, can you analyze this and tell me if this is litter?
Experience.
But where I'm going with that is, yeah, it's something's different. And you've learned to recognize a lot of things. And literally, that's a lot of people who find meteorites. They think something's different about it. They may not even be able to tell, but it doesn't belong.
Right, right.
You know, and yep. That's the difference, you know, between a smashed up aluminum can and a chunk of hematite. You can throw both of them out, and the kids will pick up the can and throw it away. And they'll ignore the hematite. You know, and you might look at it and say, well, how do they know? A dog couldn't tell the difference.
A meteorite sniffing dog.
You're curious about, there are such things, by the way.
That's great.
That's awesome.
Well, so let's come back to the question I started off our interview with, which is what Idaho meteorite is a major showpiece in the Smithsonian's collection? Can you help us out with that one?
Okay. The answer to that is the Oakley Iron Meteorite. And what's possibly even more exciting about that is the shape of it looks like it's a piece off a larger meteorite.
Ah, so there could be a bigger piece out there.
Exactly. And lots of people have gone out and looked. You know, they try to find the area where these kids were walking along. But it could be anywhere, you know, over a very large area. It could
right.
be 100 kilometers away. It could be in Boise.
Right, right.
But if you, it's kind of like if you had a broken piece of a car, and you study the cars, you'd realize this isn't the whole car. There's more to it based on the crystals and the shape and, you know, in order for something to look like that. So there's a excellent chance that there is a very large iron meteorite somewhere out there. The problem is we don't know which direction either.
That's awesome.
We don't know which way this came in. It could be Boise. It could be Pocatello. It could be Sun Valley. It could be Salt Lake City. I mean,
who knows? We might get some phone calls from people who might find it.
Yeah, I think we need to do a call out for everyone to start looking for the larger piece.
That's awesome.
All right, we want to thank. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, we have to send pictures. We want to thank Dr. Martin Horsey for joining us today. And to learn more about this topic, please visit meteorite-times.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, good sir.
Thank you.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at KISU.org or send email to noidkisu@isu.edu.